out on a baseball legend and a different perspective on him than you might have had before. Charles Learson is the author of several books, including Blood and Smoke and Crazy Good, the story of Dan Patch. His newest is entitled Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. Charles, thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
It's a wonderful book, and I love the fact that very early on, as you debunk some of the stories about Ty Cobb that everybody has accepted as fact, you reference one of my favorite movies, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, where the line was, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend, and that's certainly what's happened with Tyrus Raymond Cobb through the years.
It sure has, Rich. The interesting thing about Cobb, there's really two stories that I covered in the book. One is the story of Ty Cobb, the flesh and blood human being who played baseball as well, if not better than anyone else, had the highest batting average of all time, .366. It's still the record. And the other is the story about the story, which is this strange thing that happened to Ty Cobb after he died in 1961, where this myth started to form around him, is that he was the most terrible human being and a horrible racist and a misogynist and mean to children and everything else. And that started, as I say, after his death and based on no new evidence. So that's kind of a study in mass psychology, nothing to do with baseball, but it's fascinating in its own right.
And much of that has to do with the book written by Al Stump. Anybody who saw the movie Cobb with Tommy Lee Jones fictionalized that even more. And Stump clearly had an axe to grind, as did some other people along the way, Double Duty Radcliffe for one. And there were a lot of folks who said things about Cobb, especially when he was not around to answer to them.
That's right. It was easy to make assumptions about Cobb because he was born in Georgia in 1886. Right at the height of the depth, if you want to say, of the Jim Crow period. But what people don't know, what I found, and to my surprise, because I wasn't in this camp when I started, I thought Cobb was a monster too. But when one of the first things I found was that Cobb descended from a long line of abolitionists, that his great-grandfather was a preacher who preached against slavery and was run out of town for it. His grandfather refused to fight in the Confederate Army because of slavery. His father was a state senator who stood up for the rights of his black constituents and broke up a lynch mob in town once and had a very short career as a politician because of his stances. So that was Cobb's background. People love this idea. What Al Stump did, Al Stump took a few germs of truth about Cobb's behavior, his drinking and driving, and he spun it into a horrible monster story that really resonated with people. And then when people repeated it, they embroidered on it. I like to say that Stump started a snowball rolling that turned into an avalanche of lies, because everyone who picked up on the story added something to it. Another biographer came along in the 80s and added this level of racism that Stump didn't have in his original book, and that got added to it. And people just love to tell the story. And while I was researching the book, people would say to me, "Are you going to tell this story about how Cobb stabbed the black waiter and killed him in Cleveland?" And I know where that comes from. It comes from a fight he had with a white bellman in a hotel in Cleveland, but it's been distorted and twisted out of shape to that extent.
And as you point out in the book, too, Ty Cobb was not a lovable guy, and his temper often got the best of him. And did you find in your research that it was that temper and the fact that he could be easily prodded that helped build this reputation that's existed for more than half a century?
Yes, that's true, Rich. The myth and the monster stuff and the horrible human being stuff, it got some traction in the beginning because Cobb was a very intense guy and high-strung, highly emotional. He got in a lot of fights in his day. He didn't start any fights, usually. He wasn't usually the provocateur, but he had an exquisitely short fuse, and so it didn't take much to get him going. So if the slightest insult or hint of an insult, he would react. So he was that kind of intense guy. He pushed himself very hard. He was in the major leagues for 23 and a half years, and the whole time he was playing, he was kind of sick, actually, from worry and concern about his career and always pushing himself harder. So he made himself miserable being great. He was that kind of guy. So the myths of him being overly a monster kind of were an exaggeration of that and a gross exaggeration of it.
We're talking with Charles Learson. His new book is entitled Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. I love in the opening of the book because I knew nothing about it, even though I was aware that a number of baseball players especially worked the vaudeville circuit. I had no idea that Cobb had spent time on stage doing some acting.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was fascinated by that myself, and I used it in the first chapter as the opening of the book. In 1911, Cobb was clearly the best baseball player in the world, in the United States. He hit .420 that year, and he set numerous records. But in those days, because baseball players couldn't make much money on the field as baseball players because of what they call the reserve clause, which bound them to their team, and no one could be a free agent and negotiate his own salary. So they couldn't make much money as ballplayers, and yet they were becoming very famous. This was a new thing, this fame and the celebrity of athletes in the early 20th century. We have to remember that. So that they were trying to cash in on it somehow. So, as you say, a lot of them went into vaudeville. A lot of them tried to get endorsements. Cobb did this three-act comedy play called The College Widow, and he toured with that just like an actor. So he was actually not so bad in it, according to the reviews.
You point out that, and he didn't think of himself as a natural talent, that he had to work at it. He talked in interviews later on in his life about how hard he worked to analyze the game, the thousands of hours that he put in preparing. And he was a very intelligent, intellectually curious guy. But I wonder if you found that he was resentful of those players who did have that natural talent.
Well, I don't know that he was resentful. You know, he wasn't. He had a lot of friends in baseball. I know that flies in the face of the myth. And he could be a fascinating guy to be around because he was a great conversationalist one on one. He wasn't a great public speaker, but in smaller conversations, he was known to be a great raconteur. A lot of guys, very smart baseball players like Bo Berg, the famous catcher, who was a spy for the United States in the service and went to Princeton and Harvard Law School, hung around with Cobb, was Cobb's friend. Cobb was always reading. He would be given gifts of books when he appeared at different ballparks around the country. And he was always reading biographies of Napoleon and Thomas Jefferson. And his single favorite book was Les Miserables, which he read over and over again during his life. So he was fascinated with French history in particular. You know, one time he negotiated a new salary, a new contract was coming up, and he had 2 points so he thought why he should make more money. One was that he had a small window of opportunity to make money, as all athletes do, and the other was that he had to give up reading novels because he couldn't strain his eyes because that might hurt his batting average. So I think he was the first and last baseball player ever to complain that I can't read novels, so I should be compensated for it.
He also spoke openly about Babe Ruth and the fact that the home runs and that style of play sort of seized the day from his approach, which was about based on speed and aggressiveness. He said some things later in his career publicly that made people believe that he and Ruth were close. And you point out that they did do some things together, but would you describe them as friends?
Well, I think at the end they were. In the beginning they were... They were rivals, especially in Cobb's mind. I think Ruth was more easygoing than Cobb, and well, everyone was more easygoing than Cobb, but so that didn't take much. But Cobb had, as you say, a particular style of play, the old school style of play, where you would just hold the bat high, kind of, and bat the ball over the infielder's head, and it was, you know, the hit 'em where they ain't style of play that was in the early 20th century when the ball didn't travel as far. When the new ball came in, and a livelier, bouncier ball in 1919, it was just happened to be the time when Babe Ruth was coming along, making the transition from pitcher to outfielder, and swinging for the fences, and so that was a great coincidence, a serendipity, where the new ball came right when this slugger was coming along. Cobb resented that, didn't like it. It was a less scientific way of playing baseball, and at first he said it was wrong. And at first he resented Ruth, and they almost came to blows a couple of times on the field. But then after, when they retired, they sort of got together. They were drinking buddies. They golfed a lot, famously. And they had a connection, too, in that Cobb had gone out with Ruth's wife when he was a teenager in Georgia. So that was maybe a little too close of a connection for Ruth, but yeah, they wound up buddies in the end.
Now, we all know about his investments in Coca-Cola, but you also learned in your research that he offered to share some investment advice with, among others, some people up in the press box, some of the sports writers, and of course, being sports writers, most of them didn't take advantage of the opportunity.
Right. I say that in keeping with a sacred press box tradition regarding the accumulation of wealth, they denied to act on his advice about Coca-Cola stock. And they would have been, one guy said, I quoted, he said he would have had $750,000. That was in the 20s or 30s. During the Depression, Coca-Cola actually did very well. And Cobb became rich between Coca-Cola and GM stock. And he died a multimillionaire, very rich man. Of course, after his retirement, his life wasn't too happy. He lost two children. He went through two divorces. And he didn't have a very happy life after retirement, but his story overall is one of, you know, he was the most exciting baseball player you could argue in history, because someone once said that watching Babe Ruth hit a home run is less exciting than watching Ty Cobb get a walk, because when Ruth hit the home run, it was over in one flash, but when Cobb got on first base, then the fun really began. He'd scratch and claw his way around the bases, and you know, everyone would be delighted by it.
And while he played hard and played aggressively, you didn't find a lot of evidence that he was the dirty ball player that the legend would have us believe. And by contrast, there were a number of players who talked about the fact that he rarely came in spikes up if he was coming into second base.
Yeah, that was one of the biggest surprises for me, because, as I say, when I started off, I thought he was a dirty player and a bad guy. But one of the things I found was the myths of the spiking and all were started really by the sports writers and kept going by the fans. You have to realize that when he came up in 1905, the people that were sitting in the stands watching him hadn't played organized, certainly scholastic ball where they had exposure to spikes themselves. Spikes were this mysterious, exotic thing that people put kind of too much stock in. They thought the players would be killing each other with these shoes, and Cobb became the leading figure in that myth. But the other players, to a man that I interviewed, told me one after the other that he does not come in with his spikes high. He tries to be elusive rather than violent. He had nine different styles of slides. Cobb did, and virtually all of them were all about giving the guy as little as possible to tag. There were all these fadeaway, these subtle, these curlicue slides. He even had a slide he called the cuttlefish slide, because he scooped up a lot of, just like a cuttlefish squirts ink, like a squid. He sprayed dirt in the face of the catcher when he came in, making it more difficult for the catcher to tag him. That's what I mean when I say he was one of the most exciting players, if not the most exciting player of all time.
Well, and certainly talent-wise, at or near the top of the list, with that high batting average, .366, the greatest of all time. How do you summarize Ty Cobb the man, though, after all of the research that you've done?
Well, I summarize him as a man of principle, a misunderstood man, a complicated man, very intense, but a fascinating individual, and whose life was one of the great American stories.
Well, it's a tremendous read. I love the book, Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. Charles Learson loved it. Thank you so much for your tremendous research on this and really shedding some new light on a guy who clearly has had a bad reputation, undeserved for a lot of time here. We really appreciate you coming on with us to talk about it.
Thanks, Rich. It was my pleasure.
Charles Learson with us on Downtown. It's 20-